From NPR News, you're listening to the podcast edition of Weekends on All Things Considered, the best picks from our programs on Saturday and Sunday. I'm Guy Raz. This episode, two cover stories. First, an upgraded status for the Palestinians at the UN, but are they closer to statehood?
If a state is what we want, it makes a great deal of sense for us to get busy building one, even under occupation.
Inching towards Palestinian statehood.
If you just run to the UN and declare that you're a state, you get the territory without giving the peace, you really haven't advanced the peace process, you've set it back.
We'll hear from the Palestinian Prime Minister Salam Fayyad and former Israeli Prime Minister Ehud Olmert. Also, if the White House has its way, taxes will go up for the richest 2% of Americans next year. That's income over $250,000. But does $250,000 make you rich in every part of the country? Los Altos, California versus the cheapest place in America?
Fort Smith, Arkansas.
Huh.
$60,000 for the same house.
A look at the geography of wealth. Also, how an unknown writer went on to sell 18 million copies of his first novel, The Shack. Plus...
And the money kept rolling in from every side.
Pop star Ricky Martin on being Che in the Broadway revival of Evita. Plus, punk legend Ian MacKaye gets even with the odds. Ian MacKaye joins us. That's all in this episode of Weekends and All Things Considered.
The result of the voting is as follows. In favor, 138. Opposed, 9.
Sounds from the United Nations earlier this week, where the General Assembly overwhelmingly passed a resolution granting the Palestinian Authority non-member observer status. It's not official statehood, but a symbolic victory for Palestinians nonetheless, who celebrated the news in Gaza and in the West Bank. Israel and the United States, along with seven other countries, voted against the resolution. The U.S. ambassador to the U.N., Susan Rice, called it provocative.
Today's unfortunate and counterproductive resolution places further obstacles in the path to peace.
In a few minutes, we'll ask Israel's ambassador to the U.S., Michael Oren, why his government regards the vote as a threat. And later, we'll hear from former Israeli Prime Minister Ehud Olmert on why Israel should not have worked against that motion. But first, to Salam Fayyad. He's an economist who spent years at the International Monetary Fund. Since 2007, he's been the Palestinian Prime Minister, and this weekend, he's in Washington along with current and former Israeli leaders to take part in the Brookings Institution's Saban Forum on U.S.-Israel relations. And Prime Minister Fayyad joins me here in the studio. Welcome.
Pleasure to be with you.
How does the now upgraded non-member observer status at the UN help get Palestinians closer to achieving independence?
It by itself is a significant step. Powerful symbolism, there's no question. It doesn't get us what we want now, and in the sense of what we want being a fully independent and sovereign state of Palestine where our people can live in freedom and dignity. But it's significant. Certainly, given that was something that happened at precisely the forum that some 65 years ago gave Israel its birth certificate.
It was on the anniversary of that date, in fact, that the vote was taken.
A lot of people missed that. Actually, it was then, the 29th of November, actually, when it happened, exactly 65 years after a historic vote taken by the same General Assembly.
As you know, Israel announced the expansion of settlements in east of Jerusalem, in land that you hope will be your part of your future state. To what extent does that complicate things for you?
Enormously, and it has been going on. And actually, that's one key reason why the political process lost much of its credibility. The day after the UN vote took on a dimension of being projected as retaliatory measure. There is need, for the government of Israel to listen to voices of reason, including Israel itself. I've heard several people of note, including, I believe, former Prime Minister Olmert, who argued in favor of not opposing the Palestinian motion in the United Nations.
We'll hear from him in a moment.
After all, what is it that we did, Palestinians, to warrant this kind of reaction by way of retaliation? What we did was to go to the United Nations, the custodian of international law and legitimacy. So I think the response needs to be one that is shaped by the need to take advantage of what happened, to build on it, as opposed to continue to be scornful about it, and to really be driven by a sense of anger, frustration, or wanting to basically retaliate. I mean, that's just wrong, and it continues to create more facts on the ground that are detrimental to the prospects of continued viability of a two-state solution. I can tell you, this and other measures that may be undertaken by the government of Israel in response to what we did could cripple the Palestinian Authority and undermine whatever remains of its political viability. And again, that would be harmful to all of us.
As we'll hear in a moment, Israeli officials, when asked about negotiations, their argument is that the Palestinian Authority has been unwilling to negotiate with Israel without preconditions. Is that true? And if so, why?
You know, it isn't really. And I think this does require a bit of careful and deliberate consideration and distinction between what it is that people mean when they say negotiations, whether it is a process that they're talking about, whether it's substance that they're talking about. No one can, in their right mind, whether Palestinian or Israeli, say they're against negotiations, because the substance of what is between us and what has been between us since we had entered into this Oslo framework going back to 1993 is a path of negotiations to a settlement, a fair and lasting settlement, one that guarantees Israel security and, on the other hand, provides us Palestinians with the opportunity to live as free people with dignity and a free Palestine. That's the essence of it. The process has gone on way too long without it being productive. Not only that, but actually it's been a story of disappointment, if not really outright disillusionment. The occupation regime has not become looser. If anything, the occupation has become more deeply entrenched. So the question as to what it is that we are really involved in here, a process that is credible enough, strong enough to deliver on that which we all want to see happen, an end to the Israeli occupation, security for all Palestinians and Israelis, a lasting settlement, sustainable one and all, on the one hand, a process about this or substantive engagement. When you really actually look at what has been happening on the ground, it's very difficult to view the process as having been strong enough to deliver, either by us, Palestinians, or Israelis. So something needs to happen in order to really put things on track. We have not abandoned, nor will we abandon, the path of negotiated settlement to peace. We're committed to it. We have been. We will continue to be. But what we really need is a strong enough negotiations framework, a credible enough to deal with the credibility deficit that has been generated by failure.
How do you explain the plausibility of a peace deal, a genuine peace deal, to skeptical Israelis who say, you don't speak for the Palestinian leadership in Gaza, led by Hamas, that is unwilling to recognize Israel and seeks its destruction? What's your answer to that question?
I believe it would be wrong strategy to wait for the perfect alignment of stars before we begin to do meaningful things in a substantive way to produce outcomes. This is a serious problem, I agree. But it is not something that precludes the possibility of a meaningful negotiation between the sides. Why do I say so? Negotiations are supposed to take place between the PLO, the Palestine Liberation Organization, acting on behalf of all Palestinians. It had that power. It was empowered to do this, actually by virtue of the Oslo Accords going back to 1993, when Israel, government of Israel then, recognized the PLO as representative, legitimate representative of Palestinian people throughout the world, not only in Palestine. Now, that body is still there, and it is the body empowered to negotiate on behalf of all Palestinians. And I think if people begin to see the process moving in a serious and credible enough manner, that cannot but have positive ramifications for the prospect of reunification of our country. It's something, by the way, that I, before the Israelis, would say is absolutely necessary if we are going to have a state, because without Gaza, a Palestinian state is going to lose much of its appeal to many Israelis, because those who are in favor of two-state solution in Israel, most of them anyway, argue the case as one of an Israeli interest on demographic grounds. If Gaza is allowed to continue to drift along the path of becoming a standalone entity, that, in today's count, would mean that some 1.7 million Palestinians are dealt out of that demographic equation.
Since you've been Prime Minister of the Palestinian Authority, your approach has been to focus on institution building and creating structures. Even in the face of pretty overwhelming obstacles, there are those who say your approach is naive, including many Palestinians, that this will not bring you, the Palestinians, closer to achieving statehood. So when people ask, what's the point, what do you say?
If a state is what we want, if it is really our overriding objective, we Palestinians, that is, it makes a great deal of sense for us to get busy building one, even under occupation. You can't really build a state. You can't achieve statehood. You can't achieve freedom if you are of a defeatist mindset. You need to overcome that. And I thought by virtue of focusing on getting ready for statehood, we'd inspire ourselves and move people along with us. I thought it was immensely the right... I thought that it was really the right thing to do then, and I still do. There were skeptics from the very beginning. Unfortunately, there was validation to that point of view. With the passage of time, with us delivering on the objectives of getting our institutions to be institutions of a functional state and all, but with no prospect of the occupation ending soon, a lot more people started to buy into the theory that, well, you know, this is about adapting to the reality of prolonged occupation. Again, if a state is what we want, we had better get ready for it. I mean, that's basically what it is. It's so basic. If it was not sufficiently transformative, question for all of us now is, what is it that needs to be done to make it so?
Palestinian Prime Minister Salam Fayyad, he joined us here in the studio. He's here in Washington, D.C. for the Saban Forum on U.S.-Israel Relations. Prime Minister, thank you so much.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Before the break, we heard from Palestinian Prime Minister Salam Fayyad on what an upgraded status at the U.N. means for the Palestinian Authority. Israel and the U.S. strongly opposed that resolution. We asked Israel's ambassador to Washington, Michael Oren, why his government sees it as a threat.
Because it represents an end run of the peace process. You know, the Palestinian Authority signed on agreements with Israel that said that there'd be no alternative to direct negotiations. The only way to reach a two-state solution for two people was for Israelis and Palestinians to sit and to work out the very complex issues between us. If you just run to the UN and declare that you're a state, you get the territory without giving the peace, you really haven't advanced the peace process, you've set it back. Those are also violations of the Palestinians' commitments to the United States. The United States is co-signatory to these agreements that say that there's no alternative to direct negotiations, and that's why President Obama also opposed the Palestinian move in the United Nations.
How, though, will non-member observer status substantively change the political equation?
Well, it really won't. And the only way it could be changed is if the Palestinians try to use this non-member status in the General Assembly as a means of going to international bodies like the International Criminal Court and try to accuse Israel of war crimes, in which case that will force us to take countermeasures that we don't want to take. Actually,
countermeasures, what do you mean?
Well, the Palestinian Authority, President Abbas has now claimed he is the president of a state that includes the Gaza Strip. In the Gaza Strip, there's an organization called Hamas that has fired thousands of rockets against millions of Israeli citizens. Now, that is a war crime by any definition. And we could take him to an international court and accuse him of war crimes, too. We don't want to do that. We want to negotiate with him. And if he declares his state, and it's a symbolic measure, if he keeps it as a symbolic measure and sits down and negotiate with us, he'll find us to be a ready and eager partner and very anxious to reach this two-state solution.
You say this just as news has come out this week of several thousand more housing units to be developed in the West Bank, a territory that the Palestinians see as their future state. So, I mean, put yourself in their shoes for a moment. They have seen these settlements expand and expand and expand throughout this peace process or so-called peace process for the past 20 years, and it hasn't really changed. I mean, they don't have what they have sought. What other options do they have at this point? I mean, what else can a Palestinian leader do?
Settlements altogether take up something less than 2% of the entire West Bank. But Settlements are part of the border issue. They're part of the territorial issues. Those are one of what we call the core issues that have to be discussed at the negotiating table.
But if they keep on expanding during these non-discussions, doesn't it make it harder to dismantle them?
We understand that the Palestinians don't like settlement expansion. We get it. But there are many things the Palestinians do that we don't like. They name town squares after suicide bombers. They instruct their kids.
That's easier to change than a settlement.
But they haven't changed it. And it's educating a young generation that Israel has no legitimacy, that terror is the way to approach Israel, and rather than peace negotiations, is a serious problem. We don't make it a precondition. We say, come, all right, let's talk about it. Let's sit at the table. We don't like some of the things you do. We understand that you don't like some of the things we do. That's the nature of negotiations. We are willing to discuss everything. Everything's on the table. And just join us. For the last 4 years, they've been refusing to join us. So you ask what the Palestinians can do. They can negotiate.
Incentive do they have, Ambassador? I mean, if this settlement expansion is so problematic to them, and many countries in the international community would argue it's a violation of international law, why would they negotiate under those circumstances?
We froze settlement negotiations, settlement expansion, for 10 months in an attempt to induce the Palestinians to come to the negotiating table. They did not avail themselves of that time. So even when we freeze settlements, they're not negotiating. They may not be negotiating for many reasons, perhaps related to some of the changes going on in the Middle East. But we strongly believe that the only way for the Palestinians to change the reality on the ground, to actually have a real Palestinian state, not a virtual Palestinian state, the great way to respond to Hamas, to terror, which cannot give the Palestinians any future other than continued strife, which is not investing in education, which is not investing in infrastructure. The only way to do that is through genuine peace. And the only way to reach genuine peace is through direct and candid negotiations.
That's Michael Oren. He's Israel's ambassador to the United States. He joined me here in the studio. Ambassador, thank you.
Thank you, Guy. Good to be with you.
As I mentioned earlier, Israeli and Palestinian leaders are here in Washington this weekend as part of the Saban Center's Forum on U.S.-Israel Relations. Earlier today, we reached former Israeli Prime Minister Ehud Olmert. This past week, he said Israel shouldn't have worked so hard to defeat that U.N. resolution.
I didn't see any reason to oppose it. Look, the fundamental interest, long-range strategic interest of the State of Israel, is that we will have the international bodies and primarily the United Nations recognize the two-state solution so that there will never be any doubt as to the right of Israel to have its own Jewish independent state. Now, the fact that the Palestinians brought a proposal that they will be recognized as a state in creation, not even as a full member of the United Nations, but this emphasizes again the two-state solution is in line with the basic interest of the State of Israel. Of course, it requires negotiations afterwards. But I didn't see that this particular proposition that was adopted by the UN is in contradiction to the basic interest of the State of Israel. And why should we isolate ourselves from the entire international community and have a vote in the United Nations where 139 nations vote against us? What was so smart in this, I don't understand.
There is much speculation, Prime Minister Olmert, that a hardline Israeli government will be elected in January, again with Prime Minister Netanyahu at the helm. Do you believe that might be an obstacle to any near-term progress?
I definitely have to be hopeful that things will change, both in the politics of Israel and in the policies of Israel. But on the other hand, one can look back at the last 4 years and say to himself, that 4 years we didn't do anything that would encourage the resumption of serious, meaningful peace process. So why do we have to expect that something will change?
And if it doesn't, is time running out?
Time is certainly running out for Israel. There is no question about it. I'm very, very concerned about it because I think that if the world will not see a major progress in the dialogue between us and the Palestinians, then more and more people in the Palestinian community and in the international community will resort to the one state for two people solution. That which will change entirely the nature of the state of Israel, and I'm not sure that this is what we were dreaming all our history for.
You left politics to fight charges of corruption, which you fended off. Now that you have been cleared, is there a likelihood we will see Ehud Olmert back in politics in the future?
I think it's a fantastic question. Thank you very much, Guy. One day it will be answered soon.
One day soon, okay.
All right.
That's former Israeli Prime Minister Ehud Olmert. Ehud Olmert, thank you.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
In our cover story today, we're going to focus on a specific number, $250,000. That's $250,000, because if you earn that much, it puts you and your family in the top 2% of income earners in America. And in order to avoid the so-called fiscal cliff, the end-of-the-year deadline that'll trigger massive spending cuts and tax increases for everyone, in order to avoid that, the White House and Congress have to agree to a tax and spending plan they can all live with. Now, the White House says under its plan, if you earn more than $250,000, your taxes will go up. We'll talk more about that number in a moment, but first let's bring in NPR's Mara Liasson. And Mara, we spoke about this a couple weeks ago. There seemed to be optimism that a deal could be reached between the White House and Congress. Is that optimism still there?
I think we're still there. I think what you saw this week was a lot of kabuki theater. At least that's the optimistic interpretation of what you saw this week. You saw the Republicans angrily reacting to the opening negotiating bid that the president laid down, say he's not serious, things have really slowed down, I'm very disappointed. The president went on the road to rally his supporters. But I think it's really important that both sides show their bases that they fought as hard as they could before they buckle down and compromise.
A big part of the president's plan hinges on this number that we just mentioned, a $250,000. He wants to increase taxes on families who earn that much money and more. That seems to be a red line that the White House has laid down.
That is a red line. He did campaign on this. He said he wants the top 2%, 250 and above, he wants their tax rates to go back to the Clinton era rates of around 39.6%. But he has signaled that maybe he could compromise somewhere in between the current 35% and the Clinton era rates.
I mean, a lot of economists, Mara, have looked at this and said you can't raise the kinds of revenue that you need to raise simply by capping deductions. You have to not just cap deductions, but you also have to raise rates on the highest income earners.
Well, that's what the president says. Mm. He says to Republicans, you say we can do all this through closing loopholes. Show me the math, because he doesn't think it adds up. If you can do this mathematically, if you take away every single deduction for every single taxpayer, including those making under $250,000.
So is that the Republicans' response? I mean, have they been able to say, hey, here is the math, and we're going to show you exactly how you do it?
No, they haven't done that yet. They have mostly focused on the president's proposal. They haven't laid out specifics of their own. They have laid out principles. But both sides, I think, know that they're going to have to cave. The Republicans will have to cave probably on tax rates, not just tax revenues. The Democrats will have to give in on entitlements much more than they've talked about doing so far.
Mara, let me ask you about the politics of this, and specifically about this idea floating around Washington of triangulation, essentially the president kind of playing Mitch McConnell, the Senate Republican leader, off of John Boehner, the Speaker of the House.
Well, John Boehner is the most important Republican in Washington right now, and he's the one who's going to be making the deal with the president. Mitch McConnell is the minority leader of the Senate. He's facing his own reelection 2 years from now. He could get a conservative Tea Party primary challenge. I don't think it's a matter of triangulation, but I do think that the politics of this has changed since Election Day. The president won. He did campaign on raising rates, and he is negotiating in a completely different way than he did last time. He's going out to the country to make his case instead of just sequestering himself in a closed room or on the golf course with John Boehner. And this makes Democrats very happy, by the way. They thought he caved last time, and they like the way he's negotiating now. And this is going to help him bring his own Democrats to the ultimate compromise that I think Mr. Obama knows he has to make.
That's NPR's national political correspondent, Mara Liasson. So if a deal is reached along the lines of what the White House wants, a big part of the increased tax burden could fall on wage earners making more than $250,000 a year. because at $250,000, the government considers you to be rich. But rich can also be a relative term, depending on where you live.
JCCS, this is Tracy.
Hi, Tracy. Is Jim around?
He is. One moment, please.
So we called up Jim.
Hello, this is Jim.
Hey, Jim. Guy Raz here from NPR.
Hi, Guy. How you doing?
Good. Jim Gallipo, a certified public accountant.
With Junkermeyer, Clark, Campanella, Stevens in Missoula, Montana.
In Missoula, Montana. And then, about 1,000 miles to the west.
Dan Morris.
We called up Dan Morris, who has a CPA firm in San Jose, California.
No, I have... My client base is global, so...
So Dan actually lives in Oregon.
I commute long distance.
Oh, okay, I got you. It's cheaper living in Portland than San Jose,
isn't
it?
It is, it is. So I understand the realities of these, you know.
Anyway, we called up these two accountants, Jim and Dan, to help us run through expenses for a family of four earning $250,000 a year in Missoula and in the Silicon Valley. And the information you will hear is based on real families they serve.
You want me to kind of go down a list of the larger items?
Now, near San Jose...
We've got engineers. You've got a very high-educated workforce here.
So that couple he's describing works for a company in high-tech. But in Missoula, to make that kind of money, it comes from running a small business.
With that kind of income, they have a second residence, a lake place, or so you've got about $42,000 on those mortgages.
That's $3,500 a month for two houses. But in San Jose, for a single, relatively modest home?
A statistically average kind of house in the Silicon Valley, let's call that $3,500 a month. In a mortgage payment.
Well, in Montana, take the car payment and throw in a boat at the lake.
Vehicles, a boat, camper, various things like that, and that's about $1,000 a month.
In San Jose, the husband and wife each have separate commutes, so two separate cars.
So you're probably going to spend another $1,200 a month for cars, either they're between payments, interest, insurance, and gas, and maintenance.
While in Montana, besides some savings...
They try to put away about $1,000 a month for college funds for the two kids.
But in San Jose...
You've got daycare, or you have the nanny at home that you're doing legitimately. You're probably spending another $1,000 to $2,000 a month per child.
And then those two high-tech workers, advanced degrees, which means student loan debt.
So your student loan payments could be another, you know, between $500 and $2,500 a month.
And we haven't even mentioned real estate taxes.
Another $1,000 a month.
Much higher in San Jose. Same with utilities.
You probably have $500 in utilities. So you haven't talked about your 401k or IRA money to put away money for a rainy day.
So after all that and daily expenses in San Jose...
$250,000 pretty much went away. Yeah.
Meanwhile, in Missoula, Jim Gallipo says you've still got $4,000 to $5,000 a month left in disposable income.
$250,000 a year would definitely, easily in the top 10%, probably the top 5% of income earners in Missoula.
So I put a question to Dan Morris in San Jose. Do you think that it's fair for, you know, somebody, say, living in Missoula, Montana, who earns $250,000 a year, versus somebody who lives in San Jose or San Francisco and also earns $250,000 a year, to pay the same amount in federal income tax?
Oh, what a loaded question. Yes, it's fair, and here's why. It's fair because the people who live in Missoula, Montana, made an election or a choice to move in Missoula, and most of them aren't making $250,000. But they also have to suffer really long winters. Silicon Valley has great winters. They have phenomenal weather. I mean, you can walk around in short pants generally on most January 1st.
Now, if that family in Missoula wanted to move to San Francisco and wanted to maintain that lifestyle, they'd have to start earning a lot more money. Because to live that way on $250,000 in Missoula would require $407,000 a year in San Francisco. And that's not even the most expensive place in America, according to Linda Stern, a personal finance columnist with Reuters.
The most expensive place to buy a house is Los Altos, California.
Oh, it's not Manhattan.
No.
Los Altos, California, which is in the Silicon Valley.
Well, the average price for a four-bedroom, two-bath house, something like $1.7 million.
Hmm.
Not a fancy house.
Wow.
That was Steve Jobs' neighborhood.
All right, so $250K doesn't take you that far in Los Altos, California, compared to the cheapest place in America to live, which is?
Fort Smith, Arkansas.
Huh.
$60,000 for the same house.
Where is Fort Smith?
It's near the Oklahoma border.
But if you live there, you could get a pretty good house for $60,000?
Right. There's ways. The best way to manage your money is to get somebody from Los Altos to pay you their scale, but do your work, you know, on the computer from Fort Smith.
So like telecommute from Fort Smith,
Arkansas.
Telecommute
from someplace that's not rich, but
yeah.
Get paid by a place that has a higher standard of living.
All right. Let's talk about what might happen if, say, taxes are increased for people making $250,000 or more. Some people have argued that the segment of the American population that is going to take the biggest hit are people making between $250,000 and $500,000, but that the ultra-wealthy, really, their burden isn't going to change a whole lot.
Well, they're talking about changing the top tax rate from 35% to
39.6%.
Right now, the top tax rate doesn't hit you until you're at almost $400,000.
Hmm.
So the people between $250,000 and $381,000 or something like that, their tax rate would go up from 33% to 39.6%. They would have sort of the biggest marginal increase in their tax rate. Of course, the way marginal taxes work, it's only on that higher level of income that you're paying the higher amount.
That rate, right.
So if they raise taxes on people earning over $250,000 and you only earn $260,000, you'll have to pay a marginal amount more on the amount between $250,000 and $260,000.
Is it fair to say that the bottom line is that after January 1st, the vast majority of Americans will pay more tax or just the top 2%?
Well, there's also the payroll tax, which was a temporary tax cut of 2 percentage points on your Social Security tax. Everybody that works got that break for the last 2 years. And it's not impossible, but it's unlikely that that will be continued next year. So people will see an immediate effect on January, their first paycheck in January, because their paycheck will probably be reduced by bigger Social Security tax.
All right. Okay. Linda Stern, thanks.
Thank you.
Linda Stern, she writes the personal finance column for Reuters.
Oh, yeah. Can you give me some personal?
Yeah.
I'm just looking for some personal tips.
Stay with us. Anticipating the big NASA announcement tomorrow, plus how the CIA became gay-friendly. It's All Things Considered from NPR News. 5 years ago, Paul Young was working three jobs outside Portland, and he decided to write a book, a Christian story of redemption, really just for friends and family. He ran off about 15 copies at Office Depot, and he called it The Shack. Well, one of those copies caught the attention of two California-based pastors. They brought it to 26 publishers, all of whom rejected the manuscript. So the pastors set up their own publishing company and printed the book themselves. They started a whispering campaign among churches, and today The Shack has sold more than 18 million copies.
The story resonated so deep, because the book gave people a language to have a conversation about God that was not a religious conversation, but a relational conversation.
Paul Young has just released his second novel. It's called Crossroads, and it tells the story of Anthony Spencer. He's a ruthless businessman who ends up in a coma, and that's where his journey to salvation begins.
What can happen in that space, in the space between life and death? Inside that space is where I find Tony and then begin to help him deal with his own choices.
This book and your previous book, as we'll talk about, is very much about faith and about grace. And in this one, we're talking about a man who is estranged from God. That's who he is when we meet him.
Correct. He's kind of an agnostic for whatever the reasons are. Yeah.
And this is about reconnecting with God.
Yeah. And from a different point of view, it's also about the question, how does God break in? If God really is good all the time and is a being who pursues us with relentless affection and yet is not a violator of our ability to choose, how does that God find a way into our resistances?
I want to ask you about the phenomenon of Paul Young, because 10 years ago, we should say, you were not even published. You didn't even have an agent. You didn't have anybody interested in your work. You published your first novel, The Shack, on your own, quite literally, right? You took it to Kinko's or something.
That was Office Depot. And it's even worse than that. I had no intention of publishing it. It had never even crossed my mind to publish it. So it's not like this was a career path or a great desire or a burning wish or any of those kinds of things. All I was trying to do was get it done for Christmas.
It was a story that you wanted to write for family and friends.
Correct. Mostly at the encouragement of Kim.
Your wife.
Yep. And Kim had been saying, you know, someday, as a gift for our kids, and we have six kids aged 19 to 32, Would you put in one place how you think, because you think outside the box? And that's all I was trying to do, is get that done by Christmas.
The story of The Shack, your previous book, is about Mackenzie Phillips. He's a father, essentially a terrible tragedy. His daughter is abducted and killed. And this sort of spirals him into a deep depression. He goes to a shack, literally a shack, to try and find whatever it is he's looking for. And that's really where we get into that story. How did you come up with that idea?
You know, people have asked me, how could you use this particular scenario for your kids? And I'm going, well, you know, to me, the greatest loss a human being can experience is the loss between a parent and a child. There is something about the way that you love your children and the loss that happens when you lose a child that is beyond any kind of pain that anybody experiences anywhere else. And that loss, especially in the face of evil or tragic circumstances, those losses ask some of the best questions. Questions about why and who is God? And if God is good and powerful, why didn't God stop this? Or on and on and on. Real questions. And those are the ones that I wanted to talk to my own kids about.
I read that you've said that time, that brief period of time that character, Mackenzie Phillips, spends in the shack is actually a metaphor for an 11-year period of your own life.
That is absolutely correct.
You've been open about your own pain and the pain that you caused others. You were sexually abused as a boy. You were not always faithful to your wife. When you wrote The Shack, did you see it as the kind of book that might be able to help somebody who was in a similar situation get out of it?
No. I saw it as a way to communicate to my kids a story about who the character and nature of God who showed up in my life and brought some healing is. Because I'm a religious kid from the core.
You were the child of
missionary parents, and my dad was a preacher, and my relationship, for example, with my father, very difficult and very painful. And it took me 50 years to wipe the face of my father completely off the face of God. And so I'm not writing this in order to try to help someone. I'm writing this to explore my world for my kids in order for the questions to be okay. These are good questions, and these are questions about faith, about the kindness, the goodness of God, things that were really such a struggle for me.
I'm speaking with writer Paul Young. He's the author of the novel The Shack, which has sold 18 million copies. His new book is called Crossroads. In both of these books, The Shack and Crossroads, you represent God and Jesus and the Holy Spirit in, I would say, some non-traditional forms. And as you know, there's been controversy about it. I mean, there are people who've called you blasphemous.
My mom used the word heretic.
Heretic, forgive me.
She did. When Papa came through the door, and for those of you who haven't read it, you know, Papa, who is God the Father, is a large black African-American woman. And
this is in The Shack, I should mention.
Yeah, exactly. My mom closed the book, called my sister, and said, "Your brother is a heretic," you know. And she meant it. And it took a whole series of beautiful situations for her to get across that bridge. But yeah, I've had this pushback about the imagery. But let me say that in general, the overwhelming response has been positive.
How has the process of writing these books and sort of burrowing deep into your mind and all of your experiences and all things you know about your faith, how have those things changed your faith, changed the way you think about it and look at it?
You know, I think it's deepened things. It hasn't changed things, because when I look at my life and I look at the mess and I look at the 11 years of working through all my stuff, everything that matters to me was in place before I wrote The Shack. You know, The Shack didn't bring me identity, worth, value, significance, security, meaning, purpose, love, any of those things, the things that really matter. I had this experience, and this was early when the Shack had just begun to take off, and I woke up in the middle of the night, and it's never happened to me before. It's never happened since. And I was literally caught in a waterfall. It was like I was sitting up in bed in a waterfall of creative ideas. And at about an hour into this, I thought to myself, I need to get up and write this down. And it all stopped. And I really felt the voice, you know, to me it's the Holy Spirit, who just said, "Isn't that what you always do? You don't trust that creativity is a river." And I said, "You're right. I don't trust. And I said, I'm not going to live like that anymore. And immediately the waterfall started again for another hour until I fell asleep. And so every time I go to write, my first thought is, I trust. I trust that this is a river. And part of that is I'm 57 years old. I have finally got to the place in my life where I want to live just inside the one day's worth of grace.
Paul Young, he's the author of the novel The Shack that sold 18 million copies. His new book is called Crossroads, and it's now out. Paul Young, thank you so much.
Guy, thanks. It's been an absolute pleasure. Thank you.
And it's time now for music. Since the age of 12, Ricky Martin's been one of the biggest pop stars in the world. But this year, he took a break from the studio to work on stage as the character Che in the Broadway production of Evita.
And the money kept rolling in from every side.
It's the first time Ricky Martin's performed on Broadway since 1996 when he was in Les Miserables. And since that time, he says, he's been thinking of a way to get back into the theater.
Oh, man, I've been talking about Evita for maybe 5 years now. My agent, he came to me and he told me, what do you think about, you know, going back to Broadway? And I said, you know what, this is exactly what I need at this point in my life. I need the audience. I need to be on stage. I need to allow myself to feel emotions like the ones that I go through every day on stage as I'm portraying Che.
Tell me before I waltz out of your life, before turning my back on the past. Forgive my impertinent behavior, but how long do you think this pantomime can last?
It's amazing. This character is really intense. He goes from love to hate to anger to joy in the same scene, so it's been very healthy for me as an actor.
What did you want do differently with your portrayal of Che?
Well, first of all, the Che that Andrew Lloyd Webber wrote was Che Guevara. And I felt I was going to be a little bit limited. Instead of being just Che Guevara, why can't I be the voice of the people? And people loved her, Evita. People hated her. People didn't know what to do every time she showed up. She still is a big phenomenon. So I said, can I just play someone that can really just judge her every minute or fall in love with her the next? And I was very lucky that he allowed me to go there. So I'm not wearing the hat, I'm not wearing the beard, I'm just the voice of the people.
Oh, what a circus! Oh, what a show! Argentina has gone to town over the death of an actress called Eva Perón. We've all gone crazy, mourning all day and mourning all night, falling over ourselves to get off of the misery, right?
You said that that when this opportunity came up, you felt like it was the perfect time. Like you said you needed this for yourself.
Mm-hmm.
Why did you need it?
Well, I think what I learned doing Les Mis many years ago did so much for me as an actor, as an entertainer, that I wanted to feel the stage of the theater again. It's just a completely different monster. I'm used to being on the road all the time and performing every night in a different city, and it's very different. It's very challenging, and this is what I needed today.
That's the thing. I mean, you are, how can I put this simply? You're one of the biggest stars in the world, right? I mean, you play, you can play stadiums and arenas and fill them night after night. And here you are, you're part of an ensemble cast. I mean, you're one of the stars, and obviously a lot of people are coming to see you, but it's not just you on the stage. There are many people.
I'm on stage every night with Tony winners, and all I have to say is that I know nothing. Every night, it's a different feeling, a different vibe. The audience brings in a completely different energy every night. A lot of people ask me, you've been doing it for so long, for 8 months, the same show every night. Aren't you tired? And I'm like, not at all. It's very refreshing every night.
Have you ever felt nervous about doing this?
I'm nervous every night, my friend. Getting ready, going over the lines, the melodies, the harmonies, the dialogue, before I walk on stage for every scene, I feel this shot of adrenaline, and it's really intense. I cannot say that I am completely comfortable yet. People don't notice, But I'm going through a lot every time I walk on stage, which is part of doing theater. That's why it's so so addictive, I must say.
How is the applause in that theater different from the applause you receive when you're singing?
It's very competitive. I mean, every night you fight for that standing ovation at the end of the night. And if you do something wrong, the domino effect is chaotic. And you must not allow yourself to make mistakes whatsoever. So in that case, theater, it's fascinating because of the discipline that you need.
You have essentially been on the stage or in the public eye more or less since you were 12, since you were really a little kid.
Yeah, that's true. 1984.
I mean, you really didn't ever have a normal childhood. You weren't able to do that, I guess.
What's normal? It's all relative. I guess this is what I was supposed to live, what I was supposed to go through. I guess it made me who I am, and I would do it all over again. I met fascinating people along the way. I traveled the world several times, and it's one of those things. Why am I in the music business? Well, I go to different countries like Thailand or Haiti, and I talk about human trafficking or I talk about AIDS, and people listen. And that's when everything clicks. Mm. Oh, this is why I'm doing this. This is why I had to leave my house at the age of 12. And, you know, that's where everything makes sense.
I'm speaking with pop superstar Ricky Martin. He's currently starring as Che in the Broadway revival of Andrew Lloyd Webber's Evita. I'm curious to ask you about obviously a very public change in your life when in 2010 you publicly acknowledged that you are gay. Did it substantially change your life or the way people react to you?
Oh, my God. I wish I had the courage to do it way before, to be honest. I feel so much better with myself. I look at myself in the mirror and I said, hey, buddy, you know what? Good job. Congratulations. And apparently it's been not only good for me, but great for many people around the world. I've received letters, emails, tweets from parents, from members of the LGBT community, thanking me for sharing my story. And it's been a very, very beautiful journey, not only for me, but for my entire family. I became a father 4 years ago. And I just wanted my kids to know who I am and what I've been through and the decisions that I had to make in order for me to decide to even become a father. And it was very beautiful.
How has being a father changed the way you think about your career? In other words, can you imagine going on a grueling tour around the world with your boys and doing that like you did before they were born?
Oh, my God. You know, my kids were born on the road. I take them with me everywhere, and obviously, yes, now my decisions are based on their well-being. Now they're going to school, now we live in New York City, now we have more of a schedule routine, but they're with me all the time. They go to sound checks every day, and because of it, you know what, they're playing drums at the age of 4, so I find it fantastic.
Ricky, I should mention that you're talking to us right now from your dressing room. In just a few hours, you are going to be on stage once again as Che in Evita. And your last performance will be on January 26 next year. What are you going to miss most about it?
Oh, my God, everyone that I work with. Not only the people on stage. We're 130 people working in for this show, from technicians to producers to choreographers, lighting engineers, sound engineers. It's a big family. We live in a bubble. We've been in this theater for the last 9 months, and we spend here most of the day. And I'm really gonna miss them. We've bonded in a very beautiful way, and this is a new family that I've found.
That's international superstar Ricky Martin. He's currently starring as Che in the Broadway revival of Evita, and you have until the end of January to see him in that role. Ricky Martin, thank you so much, and congratulations.
Much peace, and thanks for allowing me to talk to your audience.
And it's time now for music. And today, the evolution of a man known as the godfather of hardcore punk. Listen to Ian MacKay's career through three phases of different bands. First, just after he finished high school, the unambiguous fury of Minor Threat. And then, in the mid-1980s, he started the more subtle and experimental band, Fugazi. Both those bands are considered seminal in the history of American punk music. Now, with his latest project, Ian MacKay has shifted once again. The do-it-yourself ethic is still there, but the sound, something entirely different. These are the Evens.
So let's go out, let's trust our weakened legs to conspire, still life to aspire.
The Evens are just Ian MacKay on a baritone guitar and his wife Amy Farina on drums. And don't be fooled by those harmonies. They often mask fierce lyrics. Their first album together in 6 years is called The Odds. Amy says she and Ian started the Evens years into their business relationship at Ian's label called Discord Records.
I was living in an apartment at the time and I had my drum set. Fortunately, I was living next to a trumpet player.
Oh, that's good, yes.
Which yeah, really right. made me feel a little more free to practice. But I did actually have my drum set up in my apartment. I think what had happened was he had offered for me to bring my set out and put it in the basement at Discord House so I could actually, you know, have a proper practice. And then one day we started to play together. And we wrote a song the first, you know, within moments of sitting down there in the basement. And it was, I think both of us were pretty taken aback at how easily it came.
I read that part of it came about in reaction to the way the alcohol industry seems to have taken over the music industry.
The band didn't come as a reaction to that. However, the way we navigate where we play, I think that we took that into account. When we started playing, I mean, one thing that had kind of come up is that over the years playing in Fugazi, I had found, you know, it was becoming increasingly clear to me, like this sort of irony. This is our form of expression, or my form of expression, and yet the only venues in which I was allowed to perform it was in these venues where the economy is based largely on self-destruction. You know, I mean, people may, you know, there might be some
talking
quibble.
About, say, alcohol sales.
Right, of course, right, into the bars.
And essentially shuts out anybody who's under 21.
Of course, right, which is incredibly ironic considering just what an important role music plays in 16 and 17, 18-year-old kids' lives. The idea that these people can't see these bands who are actually making this music, that shows you there's a deep sickness in that system. And Amy and I talked a lot about it, and we were thinking we should try to find a way to elude that, because along with that, with those venues, is the rock and roll economy, which is crazy. Crazy the amount of money it costs to put a show on. And so if you're trying to do a show for a low ticket price, you're up against it. So what we discussed was this idea of sort of finding a way to split off from that system. And one way to do it would just to turn down the volume. By turning down, it allowed us to just play basically anywhere. We played so many weird places, and it's so great to play in a barn or to play in a museum or to play, you know, in an art gallery or a theater lobby or any, because music can be anywhere. And quite often, when you put music into an unusual, untraditional space, in many ways, the music really steps up.
It seems like the song on this record, Competing with the Till, speaks to that. there's a line in there, our audience is your clientele.
Right. Amy and I played a show at the Canterbury Arts College in England. It was a beautiful building, like filled with these giant galleries, white wooden floors, perfect room for us, like our little PA, perfect. But when we got there, the guy said, well, you're just going to play in the pub. And the pub was this little room sort of in a corner of the building.
Set up in the corner, consigned to the bars. We rearrange all the tables and chairs while the staff is playing cards.
And there was, you know, a bar with the cash register, you know, ringing the till, ding, 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 and a pool table and tables and chairs and students having, you know, afternoon drinks, whatever. you know, we said to the guy, well, these other rooms are empty. Can't we use one? There was empty rooms. We're talking about 5 feet away. There was giant, beautiful, empty rooms. Said, can we just sit up in here? He said, oh, no. You have to play in the pub. Ventilation is working. You tell by the overhead roll. It just seemed like so disrespectful to music. And I said to the guy that was helping us with the show, I said, let me ask you a question. If we were poets, would we do it in the pub? He said, well, of course not. I said, if we were dancers, would we do it in the pub? He said, of course not. Why is music getting kicked? I mean, the whole experience was such a mind blower. And I said to the audience, I said, mark my words, I'm going to write a song called Competing with the Till. Competing with the Till. Art and commerce have always been in a pitched battle. Early on, before there were bars, you know, you had, you know, snake oil doctors going around selling tinctures and lotions and potions, all alcohol-based, and they'd go out into the frontier towns, and they'd have musicians, and the people in the town would gather to hear music, and then the band would take a break, and the doctor would come out and sort of pitch his various wares. And it's kind of the same thing now. I don't think these are evil things. I don't think all this should be shut down. I just think that music is a sacred form of communication,
yeah,
and should be treated as such, and shouldn't be just dismissed as just a way to sell things. And now it's not just limited to alcohol at this point, when you think about it. Because now what you're starting to see is music being suffused by advertising. Mm. And you're seeing giant corporations, car companies, actually starting like labels and things like that. So suddenly it's become, once again, music has this very weird role as being just an introduction to a product. It's too bad.
I'm speaking with Ian MacKay and Amy Farina. Together they are The Evens, and their new album is called The Odds. Amy, the two of you are, of course, married, and I'm wondering to what extent the themes on this record kind of reflect or amplify the things that you talk about at home as a family.
I think that there's not actually a whole lot of talking that's going on at home. It's hard to have a conversation when you have a
small child,
yes,
demanding all your attention. Does he like your music?
He does like our music. He's also not shy to
tell you when he doesn't like it.
Yeah.
What would rebellion mean for the son of Ian MacKay and Amy Farina? I mean, what would he have to do? Like, listen to bad music or?
Well, he wanted to be a police officer for Halloween.
Oh, that'd be rebellion. I see.
Yes.
Okay.
So,
I don't think we're not. You know, people have asked that question, but I just don't think. Unless you self-destruct, that would be a form of rebellion. Unfortunately, it's one of the few forms of rebellion that our culture seems to permit. I remember being in high school and being struck by the rebels, the rebellious people were largely the people who were self-destructing.
And I thought, doing drugs and...
Yeah. It seemed like, what a shame. That's your only option in this culture, that you have to destroy yourself? And I thought, well, that's just ridiculous. But I haven't really thought about... I mean, right now, what does our son have to do to rebel? He has to take 25 minutes to put his shoes on. So that's a form of rebellion that will drive you crazy, you know.
Fair enough. Ian MacKay and Amy Farina are The Evens. Their new album is called The Odds. You can hear a few tracks at our website, nprmusic.org. Ian, Amy, thank you very much for coming in.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
For the week ending December 2nd, 2012, that's the podcast edition of Weekends and All Things Considered, the best of our programs from Saturday and Sunday. Our staff includes Phil Harrell, Brent Bachman, Lauren Silverman, Amy Held, Lily Percy, Acacia Squires, and Chris Connolly. Our intern is Barbara Sprunt. The technical director is Daniel Shukin. Mathoni Maturi is our senior editor. And Steve Lichtai is our senior producer. I'm Guy Raz. We're back next week with more of the best stories and features from All Things Considered on the weekend. Thanks for tuning in.